This episode of the VFX Show is brought to you by Cinefix Classic. This Kickstarter campaign aims to allow you to carry 3 decades of Cinefix magazine on your iPad, remastered and reconfigured to be searchable, browsable, and with images restored to look their best on the Retina display. Act now to pre-order the entire collection of the first 126 issues of Cinefix by contributing to the Cinefix Classic for iPad campaign, and get it as soon as it's released, around the end of the year. Go to Kickstarter.com and enter Cinefix Classic before August 16. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we are going monster crazy. It's a monster alien fest, and to join me in the slugging match that is Pacific Rim, I'm joined by Jason Diamond. How are you, sir?
What's up, man?
So New York of you, my friend.
Yeah, I try.
Yeah. And what are you? You were coming from like New York, right? Presumably it's late at night there, right? Like
Queens, actually, home of the Ramones. It is 10:15 p.m.
I see. And joining us from somewhere else, entirely different, but in the red corner, is Matt Wellen. How are you, Matt?
I am great. Yeah, here in Virginia. And hey, I was just going to say too, the thing at the beginning about Mark Christensen's thing, the Kickstarter thing, that I'm so excited about that. That is going to be so awesome.
Yeah, I'm a long time Cinefix fan. The world is a good place for having Cinefix in it.
Oh, pumped. Yeah. Just, I mean, there's so many of those old issues, like, you know, honesty, that like I've never even seen. Like, it'd be so much fun to go back and read some of that stuff.
Oh, really? I have every issue, and some of them twice. Well, number one.
I know you have every one.
I think I have like 6 number ones. I was collecting them. I think, though, that Mark is going to cause my collection to devalue overnight.
or raise in value, because people now want the physical copies.
The real deal, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, Pac Rim, a completely over-the-top popcorn movie. And I've been told I need to judge it through this kind of lens, because I posted on Twitter that I thought it was really good visual effects in what had to be like a really stupid movie. But I'm not going to color your thinking. Matt, what do you think?
Okay, well, so I saw this with my son and my wife, and we went and checked it out, and we were really excited to go see this one. And I mean, there are parts of it that I really liked, that I thought were really fun. I had a few problems with it, but I will just say that my son is 9 years old, and as soon as the last image left the screen and the credits started to roll, he leaned over to me and he goes, "Dad, when do you think the sequel will come out?" So he loved it, and he was ready. He's, I think, the target demographic for this movie, right? And he absolutely loved it, and he was ready to see, you know, Pac Rim 2 the second the movie was over. He wanted to see more.
Well, some good news for your son then is that apparently it's gone so well in China, they're actually talking about that sequel right now.
Yeah, I read that today. Yeah, I guess it's doing like really big numbers for a foreign release, which is great news for Warner Brothers, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's great news for all the filmmakers,
I guess. Everybody, yeah.
Yeah. And what did you think, Jason?
By the way, I think currently it's at 226 million.
Okay.
Worldwide. That probably doesn't take into the China stuff.
Not that they'll ever get any money out of China, though.
Yeah, true. That's the larger issue. But it's $190 million budget, which then the math is you double it to hit recoup. So they're at 380 before they even make a nickel, technically. But
yes. My China remark, by the way, for those that don't know, is there's been a report that the Chinese film receipts aren't actually getting dollars paid back to the US. They're booked. In other words, they made the money, but the US hasn't actually seen the money arrive in their bank accounts yet. As we go to air with this, it was kind of a funny situation. All the studios being owed a ton of money from China over a 2% tax argument. But anyway, enough of that. So what did you think of the movie?
That's pretty funny, because I'm pretty sure there's tons of people owed money by the studios that they won't ever see either.
Okay.
But that's just my 2 cents. Anyway, I enjoyed the movie immensely. However, the lens of the popcorn movie is a false lens. I don't believe you need to apply that, because a movie should be able to be a movie, right? And now I understand that a studio will hobble you to the nth degree with a $190 million budget and force you into certain storytelling avenues a la Inception. However,
Wait. Back up. How did we get to Inception?
Because the studio forced them to put in the snow level.
Okay. And you didn't like the snow level?
It kind of came out of nowhere. It was like Moonraker for, you know, whatever. Anyway.
Okay.
We already did that show. People can go back and listen to us argue about that.
Okay. I didn't expect you to quote.
Yeah, well, you know.
But no, go like for it. Yeah, keep going.
I like to make draw broad strokes and then put the eyeballs in last, you know.
Yeah, no.
So
I love how weird your brain is.
Yeah. So I hated Charlie Hunnam. I could not stand. He's the lead character. I could not stand his face. I couldn't stand the way he walked. I couldn't stand the way he had his thumbs in his belt for half the movie. It did not say the American bravado that they wanted.
Okay, so just let's agree for a second that in a minute we're going to get to the spectacularly good visual effects, so that we can just
Yes, of course.
If you think your country wasn't well represented, I couldn't understand the Australians. They were like, well, comprehensible,
but
and I'm an
I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell the difference between the, like, you know, the Iceman Australian guy and then the lead guy. There were times when they were on screen, I was like, wait, which guy is that? And until they spoke, I didn't know which guy I was looking at.
Yeah, but like, when the Australian spoke, it was like, oh, come on, Mike, it's going to come on, from the back. And I'm like, what did he just say? Like, I'm an Australian. I've lived here my whole life. Huh?
Yeah.
And can I just, okay, so I'm just going to match you rant for rant on this one, right?
Please.
They had the shot of Sydney. Now, I don't know if anyone has ever been to Sydney. I've been to Sydney. There's a thing called the Sydney Harbour Bridge. It separates North Sydney from, you know, the south of part of Sydney. And it's in the middle of Sydney. This is like when they put up the wall in the film, they put it between North Sydney and the south section, right, the main city section. This is equivalent to putting up a wall in California that goes within 100 yards of the Hollywood sign. Like it would, you know, like the entrance to our harbour is miles away and has a narrow entrance with two high cliffs left and right. That would be a good place to put a cliff, to put a wall across, because all you'd have to do is, you know, bridge a relatively small distance. To put it 90 degrees to that, where some alien could happily get into either the north or the south, depending on where the wall was the dumbest piece of geography in history. I mean, it really was as sensible as saying, we're going to put the wall to make sure East LA is safe from the monsters. You'd be like, what?
Well, the concept in the script of the wall is just such a dumb idea anyway. Like, they should have put the wall, like, right around, you know, the hole in the ocean floor. Like, they
could have
built
easier.
A smaller wall and saved, like, you know, billions of dollars. Like,
yeah. Wait.
A lid?
Maybe the guy that designed the wall was the same guy that thought the easiest way to get into one of these robots was to get into its head several hundred meters up in the air and then have it plummet down Thunderbird style to connect with the body. Because, hey, if you don't have a lot of resources available, the sensible thing to do is make sure every time you want to get out of it, you have to connect it to a docking bay that lifts its head up several hundred meters in the air to a platform where you can step out and step back in again.
Which also means that it has to be connected and disconnected, which causes, you know, mating cycles.
Yeah. But wait a second.
Valuable data ports.
I go better than that, right? My favorite all-time line is, we're going to set off the EM pulse. We've set off the EM pulse. Oh, no, none of our robots work. But wait, this one does. Why? It's analog. I'm sorry, what?
Yes.
It's analog. It works on gas and pistons and rods and levers. I'm sorry, I thought this thing was computer controlled. No, it wasn't computer controlled. It's analog controlled. No.
Yes, that heads-up display has nothing to do with electricity.
No, it was a mechanical device that was operated through gears and pulleys, so it's going to survive the EM pulse. Oh, well, good. That's good. I'm glad we got that sorted. But wait. It's okay, because this incredibly large, huge, incredibly heavy robot thing can be lifted by six helicopters. Well, yeah, that's handy. Exactly. Oh, wait. But the helicopter drivers are incredibly stupid because at the end, when they send out the helicopters to rescue the guy, there's one guy in one raft in the middle of the ocean. 12 helicopters fly out in a V formation and fly past him. I'm sorry. Are you that stupid that you can't see one guy in the ocean in clear weather? And even if you could, is there any point flying past him? You're in helicopters, for Christ's sake. You just stop.
Right.
There's no point.
Yeah.
But okay, wait. I got better than that. Yes. My last one, right? I want the radio that these guys used because I got to tell you, I don't get good reception around parts of LA on my cell phone. But that, I'm willing to bet that they've come up with some improvements in the future, right, that would let you get really good reception no matter where you are, including if you headed out into the middle of the ocean away from any antennas because, yeah, there's an inversion effect that happens with radio waves, right? So they can go over the horizon. But I want the radio that still keeps working when I go underwater. And I want the radio that still keeps working when I go underwater and survive a nuclear blast. And then I want that radio to still work when I go through a dimensional shift to a parallel galaxy and it can still send back signals about someone's heart rate in real time through an interdimensional shift, through millions of liters of water, through a body of ocean, through a huge amount of atmosphere back to a headquarters. That's the radio I want, kids. That's mine.
All right, so I think we could all agree that you could drive holes through the plot.
Holes?
You could drive a Jaeger or two through.
Right? Well, see, here, my thing was, it wasn't even plot holes, right? Because I'm willing to even just be fun about it. I just didn't like the storyline in between the fights.
Mm. Now, I wanted to see... Was one of those points that when they threw a punch inside the cockpit, his arm would move over 3 seconds, but the robot arm would have to move at a completely different speed?
Yes, because it's 250 feet tall.
Yes, and so if the robot falls over, the people inside the head are going to be on their backs, and so they would immediately go, oh, wow, I'm going to correct my balance so I don't fall over, which would cause the giant robot to correct its balance so it didn't fall over, which would mean that it would just... Sorry, go on. Yep.
So again, all of that notwithstanding, because I'm even willing to say I just want to see a giant robot with a freaking rocket elbow punch a kaiju. Totally fine.
Okay.
However, the story of the budgetary deficits and no one thinks it's worth doing anything because the wall's going to work. That whole storyline was just lame.
No, I think it was a really good idea funding an entire robot campaign by selling off bits of broken off aliens' dead flesh, including the second brain that still works, by the way.
Right. I would much rather have seen stories about the devastation in the cities and things like that that would weave a richer world rather than just like Top Gun with giant robots, right? So that's just my thing. But
yeah, I think it's – yeah. I mean, look, there are obviously subtle points that in the sci-fi world would not – you know, I mean, the fact that the way you work out who's compatible for a brain thing is to punch them. And, you know, if they punch you back really well, you say, yes, that's the person I'm mentally, compatible with, and they should be my co-pilot.
The neural handshake, right?
The neural handshake of punching someone in the face,
However, my comment about the film in general is that I think it may be the best visual effects I've ever seen in a film.
Okay, so we're now going to talk about visual effects. I can shut up now.
Personally.
Okay. Because I got a few more of those, but I'm just going
to
stop.
We'll leave those to the end. Well, in the glossary, we'll add a. Yes, the visual effects were stunning, in my opinion.
Yes, they were. No, they were. They were really stunning. I mean, it was just as I said. Like, I think it's a really, really good film with just really, really stupid sort of story. Here's the thing. And I mean, I think this is, you know, the sort of more of a case of this than any film we've talked about before. The only reason to see this film was the visual effects. Like, there was no actor that was sucking you in. In fact, I don't think there was any actor that would have been paid above, you know, equity, right? There was no
Idris Elba. I would have been excited to see Idris Elba, but I think it's so sad. Like, I feel like he winds up being so underutilized both in this film and in his turn in Prometheus too, where it was just like, you know, why was he even in that? You know, like, and he's such an interesting, you know, actor on screen. I mean, he's so good in The Wire, but he doesn't get any opportunity to like showcase any of his talents in these movies. I mean, he didn't really seem like he was too into this picture either. You know,
it was, I mean,
it's sort of like he was showing up and reading his lines and, you know, giving it his best shot, but it was not, it seemed kind of half.
Like, I mean, it's like Oblivion, right? It's like Oblivion, right?
I went
to see Oblivion. Like Oblivion was an average film that looked incredible.
No, I'm sorry, Jason. No, I totally disagree with you for three reasons, right? One, there were people that would have gone and seen Oblivion because it had Tom Cruise in it. Like, there was a genuine star and an associated kind of star power.
I guess that's true.
There was no actor on this that would cause you to go buy a ticket. One?
Yes. And Oblivion had Morgan Freeman too,
and Morgan Freeman, right? So there are name actors that you would say
that is true.
That's the new, you know, Tom Cruise film. I mean, there's no way you would say that's the new blah blah film when referring to Pac Rim. And then
Why do you think they didn't get like any good? I shouldn't say any good, but I mean, star. The casting was so weird in this movie. Like,
I think
there is no star.
Well, there is. No, there is a star. The star is John Knoll, ILM, you know, the rest of the team. Like, exactly. The stars are completely...
And I think for this movie, I don't think that's facetious. I think literally they led with the visual effects. Like,
yeah. Yeah. No,
did you other than Idris Elba in the trailers saying he's going to cancel the apocalypse, there wasn't that much of people in the trailers. It was all Rocket Elbow, Kaiju... punching, you know, robots, the kaiju walking down the street with holding the tanker as a bat. I mean, that alone sold me.
Oh, right? I mean, look, I think Hal Hickel and the animation team did a terrific job because some of the constraints they were placed in. I mean, okay, so just checking it now from an animation point of view, think about how hard this is. I need to get scale, but something giant would move really slowly. And something giant would move really slowly if it was moving through water. Like, you know, you couldn't get a more molasses kind of animation brief than I want giant hulking things to literally plow their way through huge amounts of water. I mean, an actor in a pool isn't going to have an action sequence that moves that fast. And yet you want to have this super fast-paced, cutting, popcorn-y kind of effects thing. You need it to be big, and yet by the same token, it's going to be at night and with water, and it's going to be really hard to see anything. And so you're going to lose a lot of the lines of action, and it's going to be hard to see what's going on. And then you're going to hide a lot of the animation behind water.
And the director wants realistic camera moves.
Yeah, I mean, I think the animation team did a stunning job in working inside the constraints of the fundamental plot premises and the plot points that... that, you know, they were required to tick. You know, I mean, characters looking like they were hurt, characters looking like they came back. Plus, there's no face on the characters. They don't really, I mean, they have a face, but they don't have, like, expression face. There's none of this kind of, like, you know, get away
from
her, you
bitch. That's an interesting, you're making a really interesting distinction, though. I mean, because I think I would agree with what you're saying, but I also think that given those constraints, I do feel like there were things about the way in which some of the action sequences were framed and composed that I found kind of problematic. Like, I felt like there were times where, with regards to the scale, like, that's the most exciting thing about this movie to me, is it's an opportunity to really go after and explore something that is really difficult to, you would never be able to photograph it in real life, right? I mean, it's this enormous scale, and that's something that visual effects are really great for doing, I think. You know, the opportunity for giant robots, giant monsters. There were times where, because of the altering of the physics and I think even some of the framing devices that were used, and I also think it was a mistake to have so much of the fighting take place at night in the rain, which is also like obscuring your ability to sort of see what's happening. But there were moments where I felt like I wanted to see like wider, you know, I wanted to see more. I wanted to see bigger. And it felt like it reminded me a little bit of some of the framing issues that I think were really omnipresent in the first Transformers film, where the action was going so fast and it was framed in kind of a medium or even a, you know, close up in some cases, where it was so difficult to follow certain elements of the action. And I found that to be problematic. I thought there were some great big vista shots as well, but then there were ones where I felt like there were great opportunities that were missed in terms of the visual construction of some of the fight sequences.
I do agree with the framing concept, because I saw this in Ann Arbor, Michigan, mm-hmm. when we just came back from like a 3-week travel job, and me and my brother and our crew went one night after we wrapped to see it. And I remember when we came out, we were all jazzed on it. We all had the same plot point problems, but I remember saying to my brother, I really wanted a wide reference shot to sort of place one big wide punch or something that showed me where they were, scale reference to a cliff or a building or a bridge or something that gave me general scale. Although I did really like the shots of like the knee in the water, because mm-hmm. I mean, you understand the scale of ocean or a harbor or something and how big something would be to just see the top, you know, just below the knee. But I do agree with the framing.
Okay. Well, if I had a second thing that I thought was spectacular, it's just the quality of the rendering, because Arnold was the primary renderer on the characters and the robots, but you know, RenderMan was used on the water, and I think they used V-Ray on something. I'm going to say some of the environment stuff, but the deep compositing pipeline, the quality of the rendering. I mean, you had a film that had huge hunks that were really just an animated film. I mean, it really mm-hmm. was vast amounts of stuff. Yeah, there are some actors, you know, in that environment, and a couple of times, I think probably most inside the Shadow Dome, I felt it looked a little bit like it was a digital background, a digital environment.
Kind of compy, yeah.
But there were points in there where I was just like, actually, everything I'm looking at in this frame has to be a complete digital render. There's just nothing worth filming. Mm-hmm. There's no live action at all. And the level of realism that they got into that, and the level of just spectacularly good lighting and volumetrics. Oh, my God. The volumetrics were just terrific. The fluid sims were terrific.
The ocean sims were mind-blowing. Like, yeah. When there's a shot where, and I had to remind myself, like you said, that it's completely animated. There's a shot where I think it's one of the Jaegers, and towards the beginning, the Jaeger walks and stops, and the way the water swirls around with the foam and the fractals and the way everything's moving around the leg, I think my mouth was open. I think
there were two sequences for me that I found particularly impressive and rewarding. So I'm not going to say that these are separate from story, because they're not. They're very much they worked at every level for me. The two scenes, I don't know if you guys agree with this. My arms come off, I'm going to collapse on the beach as a giant Jaeger shot where the guys are out doing the metal detector. Mm-hmm. Just worked at every level. It was big. It was epic. It was moving. It was believable. It was spectacular. It was visually interesting with the kind of the whites and the color and the, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. still obviously pretty saturated. So I thought that was a particularly successful sequence.
And it's one of the few daytime shots of the Jaegers.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought that really, really worked.
Well, and the composition and placement of the, you know, the guy, the kid and his grandfather or father or whatever, that really gave you and the interaction with the snow and the water,
yep.
that really gave you a very strong sense of scale, which is the thing that I thought was missing in some of the later fight sequences.
And a humanity. I mean, there was, you mm-hmm. know, it was a very well, for a, I mean, I'm not saying like it was, you know, the most, wasn't 2001 kind of lifting us to a place we'd never, ever been before. But I would say it was a hugely successful scene at every level. And the second one, I don't know if you agree with it, is the flashback sequence to her as the little girl, almost being, you know, or being terrified as the Jaeger comes and saves her at the end. I thought that was well executed at every level. It had actual genuine concern. I mean, you know, little girl, what's going to happen to her? How's this going to play out? You felt uncomfortable.
Yeah, that was genuinely, it was genuinely frightening. And I felt like that was actually one of the most sort of, you know, Del Toro-esque sequences in the film.
I had a nice style, the grade was really nice because it was kind of like,
it wouldn't say
sepia, but it was like, you know, it clearly was a flashback, but then when the Jaeger's backlit by the light and all the dust and the sun and the glow was just like, ugh, so good.
Yeah, and it had everything that you wanted. That the volumetrics and that light stuff were underlying this kind of savior thing of it coming in and rescuing her, and thus affecting her so strongly that she would want to go into the program later. There is one thing that I would say about that sequence, and it's just, I don't know if it was me or it was our print. No, it couldn't have been our print. Okay, that whole sequence was, I would have said, perfect, except for one big thing. It was in the stereo conversion, I'm assuming. There was something lower front on a shot that comes out back to the street where the, I think the little girl comes out back into the street, and it's a, we sort of tracked from camera right to camera left, and we see down the street, and there was like a cart or an element in the bottom half of the bottom third of the frame that just seemed to be completely stereoscopically wrong. It was as if it was out of order. It was comped correctly and was placed in exactly the wrong position in terms of stereo space. And it just stuck out to me like as if someone had walked up and stuck a giant object on with their thumb, with a thumbtack. It just didn't sit in the shot at all. And yet from a still frame point of view, it was perfect lighting match, perfect everything else. So it was just completely a stereo artifact, which is surprising because I would have said the rest of the stereo done by Stereo D in terms of converting the 1,900 shots was really good. And that didn't seem like a hard shot, like compared to the darn stuff they had to deal with in the ocean. But anyway, did anyone else see this shot that I'm talking about, or just me?
I didn't. I didn't notice that, no.
Wow, okay.
I saw it in 2D.
Oh, okay.
For multiple reasons.
Well,
I did have a discussion on Twitter with Hal Hickel and Paul Franklin about the conversion and how much was, you know, that it, they told me it was shot in 2D and converted later, and that Paul said he thought it was, you know, the one of the best conversions you'd ever seen. However, there was no, the times that we had to see the film, there were no 3D times to see.
Yeah.
And there were people that we were with that wore glasses or what have you and just weren't that into the 3D in general. So we just, it was just sort of like a overall decision.
I mean,
I'm not that into the 3D, but I was kind of intrigued after the Twitter conversation.
The vast amount of volumetrics and debris and stuff, it's just staggering to me that they managed to do a stereo conversion. The only thing I'd say is, and I hope this is true, they did do a lot of deep compositing on this, which means you have very accurate depth files and you have very accurate placement of objects in Z space as part of the compositing process. So hopefully that fed into stereo.
Well, you have to have that with that level of, and that, you know, those many sort of millions of particulates, right? I mean, like, it just seems like you'd have to have that data.
Hal Hickel said that they rendered their shot stereo. They weren't converted. So
okay.
That would solve some, you know, certain amount of certain problems.
Okay. Well, leaving aside the stereo for a second, that and that technical issue that I had, I certainly was like quite stunning. I mean, stunningly odd. It was like looked really odd to me. What did we think? Were there any shots that we weren't happy with? I mean, I've listed that stereo shot. Were there any normal effects stuff? Leave aside the huge plot problems of that you've got cloned monsters that have babies, just purely on effects shots.
I mean, I think the stuff that was most problematic for me, you already sort of alluded to, was inside of the big dome where they had all the Jaegers. I thought, you know, it was reminiscent to me visually of some of the shots from the two Matrix sequels where they had the ships and the dock environment and stuff, where it felt like, you know, there was some sort of a, you know, digital background and additional elements kind of, you know, assembled together in the comp. And then you had the sort of action in the foreground. And I, you know, those are just shots that are really, I think, hard to make work well, just from a sort of a conceptual point of view. And I thought some of those were, if I had to pick out anything, that would probably be my first go-to pick, were just some of those shots that I thought were, you know, not as hot.
No, I'd agree. And I'd go further and say one of the things that was hurting that was the grade. And it was not that I think the colorist did a bad job necessarily. It's just that the instructions were to make everything super saturated and have every color kind of in shot from reds to yellows to blues to look, and there's a shot on FX Guide, which is a shot inside the Shadow Dome. And you can just see it in this one shot. Like you've got blues and reds and just like everything, greens. I mean, it's just every color, which well,
I loved. I think it, oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I think it was, you mentioned how saturated everything was. I did just sort of as an aside, I thought it was so funny. I think like before the film came out, they were, you know, the trailers were getting longer in format and stuff. And I think it was Jeff, FX guy, Jeff Huser, who said he loved the trailer, but he felt like somebody threw a whole package of Skittles in his eyes.
Which I just taste the rainbow.
Yeah.
Taste the rainbow. I don't think there were any shots that really, there was no digital double stuff that bothered me. If there even was any, there wasn't. I was more focused on the larger events from the trailer that I wanted to see played out. And the other things like the gorilla kaiju, you know, like I thought that was insanely well animated because it clearly wasn't a gorilla, but it had, you know, that vibe to it. And was that the guy that gave the EMP blast? What did he do? Did he just run or did he have like a power?
The big fat guy?
Yeah,
the fat gorilla guy was just like the big. Yeah, he was just like a big brutal smasherama.
Yeah,
guy. I didn't think he was the EMP. I think the EMP guy came.
The EMP guy was in the when they first went out to, and the Russians, for example, kind of died.
Right, that was
the EMP guy, and he had that back plate ripped off him so that it wasn't used again.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think there was. Look, I understand the whole popcorn design element and that they tried to get each character that was a monster to look like you would have the ability to be made as a suit and have a person inside that suit so as to be linking back to the character designs of the old kind of Japanese kind of stuff.
Toho.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly, the guy I don't want to be right now, though normally I would not say that because I think he's great, but Gareth Edwards, who's doing Godzilla right now, he's got to be looking at like, okay, they kind of really went there, didn't they? They drunk heavily from that well.
And in the beginning, when they're doing the backstory and talking about the kaiju coming up and the first Jaeger defeating the first kaiju, I'm pretty sure there was Godzilla's roar. In like echoed in the background, seriously. Like,
see, I love that opening thing, like having that one aircraft carrier. Yeah, that was like a nice shot on the aircraft carrier.
It was great.
It was the super saturated stuff later that I understand your audio reference, but I'm ignoring it, Jason. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you. well, when we walked out of the theater, my brother said the exact same thing. He was like, "Man, Gareth Edwards is really screwed." I mean, I'm sure it's gonna be great, you know. I'm sure Godzilla's going to be awesome, but it's just, you know, you've now been hit over the head with like basically five Godzillas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I did hear though that they showed some, I don't know, a teaser or some footage at Comic-Con of the Godzilla film, and that, I mean, I didn't see any of this, but I read something about it, and that, you know, people were going bonkers. Although it is Comic-Con, people go bonkers for almost anything.
I mean, I met him with John Montgomery one night out here in New York, in the city when John was here, and he is a super nice guy, and I really think that he has the ability to do something awesome with Godzilla, regardless of Pacific Rim.
I mean, he has enormous talent. And the other thing, apart from the fact that he's a super nice guy, his style is to not do mega over-the-top. Like, he'll have an engaging story and everyone will be, you know, it'll be the, whatever you want to call it, really, the Dark Knight to this. I think Godzilla to Pac Rim will be Dark Knight to Transformers.
Yeah.
But that's just,
or me. The Avengers. Yeah.
Well, no, you see, I think Avengers was a good film and it did have some good character stuff in it.
True.
I think, you know, the Transformers
was so much better than the Dark Knight trilogy for sure.
Oh my God, you are just out of control. So I predicted it. I predicted the whole Batman in Superman 2 leading to Justice League thing. I've been saying it for 6 months to anyone that listened. Comic-Con, they said that's what's happening.
Mike, Frank Miller said that 20
I don't know who this
or
Frank
more years ago
you're referring to, but I don't know
with
him.
The Dark Knight Returns.
I'm just
Mike,
saying that's what I did.
You've been outvoted.
Let's discuss some of the weirder sequences in the film. Did anybody else see enormous practical issues with how to get the underwater fight sequences going at the rim of the Pacific Rim chasm? Like I that found that to be just such a difficult staging problem. And the atomic bomb and what seemed to be a air bubble that then implodes back on itself. I'm leaving aside the fact that you can stand a nuclear blast by putting your sword in the ground, but that was a very complicated thing for everyone on every score because it's meant to be super dark now. If it was meant to be dark above at night in the rain, you know, right. Way down below. I mean, you know, you go down, what, 6 meters and you've lost a lot of light, let alone that far down. And add to that the problem of being able to move now completely in water and still maintain some dramatic action, some threat.
And by the way, salt water having no corrosive effect on your giant metal suit.
Well, no, I that could take time. I'm okay on that one. That was one of the, like, you know, in a list of about 7,000 faults, that would be like pretty low on my list. I think I could go 9,999 before I needed to call that one up. But it was a heck of a staging problem. And how well do you think that they solved that? So it's you've got a threat, two Jaegers, and of course various monsters. Do you feel like that was a well solved sequence from a staging point of view?
I thought. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jason.
Oh, that's all right. I was just gonna say. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think that sequence might have suffered also from a scale issue, because if the Jaeger is 25 stories tall, essentially, then there's rocks that it was kind of hiding behind, which had to be, I mean, obviously it's the deep ocean, but still, I mean, a 500-foot rock in the ocean or whatever it was. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just thinking about it in retrospect and not remembering the proper staging. But it's definitely an odd, I mean, I know why they had to do it there, but it didn't, now that you bring it up, it kind of was definitely a weirder section to have a fight, although that gives you the swimming monster, you know, which was something we hadn't seen before either.
I mean, I think you make a great point about, I mean, I think that's a problem I had throughout the film was the scale. And I think the scale, you know, when you see the kaiju on the aircraft carrier that we were talking about, or when you see the first one in this sort of the prologue, right, where they show it, you know, it's in the trailer too, right, where it kind of crushes the Golden Gate Bridge and rips it apart.
Yeah.
Those were great for scale, and they really gave you a sense of place and of size. And I mean, you really felt what was going on. And I even think maybe the sequence with the little girl, the sort of flashback sequence, I thought was reasonably effective in terms of scale. They did some stuff, I think, in sound design too there that really delivered the goods. But when you talk about the staging of that underwater sequence, you know, given what you were saying, Mike, about like how dark it would be, you know, a few meters under the water, you're not going to have much light. But I think they got around that in ways that, at least for me, it never, you know, aside from maybe the scale things you're talking about, Jason, I never felt like it took me out of, you know, sort of the action that was taking place. I think it sat well within the context of the sequence because they were able to get, you know, through that, the fissure or whatever they called that thing, you know, there was a whole bunch of light emanating from that. And then they kind of cheated around and threw in a ton of other light sources as well, just to kind of, you know, boost up areas that would be really in total blackness or totally backlit in that case. And I don't know, it still worked for me. Like, I think staging wise, it was complicated because there's really no frame of reference for where you are or what you're looking at other than, you know, the robot and the monster and the hole in the ocean floor. But I thought that, you know, they did, I thought, a pretty deft handling of those issues in terms of making a sequence that was watchable and followed a narrative thread that I could make sense of as a viewer.
I mean, I do appreciate a robot with a sword. Don't get me wrong. It's Voltron style. But this brings up a similar idea to the space shot, right? When it goes up, and that's when you first see the sword, which weirdly they hadn't used prior in the fight.
Don't even start. Yeah, go on.
But, you know, they're falling from space, essentially upper atmosphere, you know. After he cuts the kaiju in half, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. that's a pretty far fall, and then it just actually hits the ground. Like, I think that was, now I think that might have been my larger
well, the only thing
that's not a visual effects problem.
That's not a staging problem. I think that's just a plot problem.
That's just a plot issue.
And we'd be here all day if we just talking about plot problems. You know,
but it looked great.
Don't get me started on the two brains still being active after it's being dead in formaldehyde. So for me, the thing was that
the re-entry was nice.
The thing for me about the underwater staging stuff is height of hubris, but I would have done that differently because I think there was an opportunity to have a more weightless fight where the problem was that they couldn't get a good, solid footing, because it felt to me like they'd gone to so much trouble to give them weight up above. I would have just staged that a bit differently to play more on the fact that you have these huge things, but without the weightlessness. And I would have gone from more of a kind of a rolling, you couldn't really, because you don't have the same amount of gravitational aid in bracing yourself on stuff, because you just don't have those forces pushing you down with the same kind of deliberate.
Yeah, your fighting tactics would have to completely change in that different environmental context. That would have been really interesting.
There were periods down below where it just felt like we were in a similar fighting scenario to what we had up on the above water level. And I think that was a missed opportunity, because I could have seen them sort of rolling and unable to. You know how you do that sort of thing where you're kind of trying to twist around to right yourself, but it's just kind of, you just don't have that sort of, you can't grab onto something, you're not sort of standing on something. And I just think there could have been some interesting stuff to do there. And so when one of the characters gets sliced all the way in two with the sword, it just felt, well, that was almost like I sort of had no nod to the fact we were underwater pretty much. It just felt like it was flying through the air and it had enough momentum that on a sharp sword, it was going to be cut in half. Under the water, it just sort of felt like, well, you would have to propel yourself to move through the water with that kind of speed, and you would.
Well, wasn't the kaiju swimming?
No, it was, but it was still like, the second you start getting cut in half, you're going to stop swimming, right? It just didn't feel like when you've got a lot of momentum in the air, there's no way to stop, and so the whole momentum of your mass just drives you onto the sword. It just felt more like in the underwater, there were sort of similar staging principles to above ground. There obviously wasn't identical, but it just didn't feel as a fluid environment as I think they could have gone with. And I felt that it meant, well, I don't know.
I think I would agree with the gravity and scale issues more than I didn't have maybe in practical terms, the slicing through the kaiju wouldn't have worked, but that's just a kill the monster moment. It just it's going to happen however it happens. It's Michael Myers falling off the second story and walking away. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter necessarily.
It wasn't so much that, it wouldn't happen in reality, but it just didn't feel like it was all happening underwater. It was almost like we got to a point where we were, because when that bubble appears, and I presume they are now in an oxygen bubble, and there are some fish flapping on the ground kind of thing, I was sort of like, oh, yeah, we're underwater. Like, it was almost like, oh, yeah, so that would be a big change, right? Because now we're like in a, and then it was back to where it was before. It just didn't feel like there was huge variations. I just would have played the underwater stuff a lot more bubbles, a lot more sort of water dynamics. I just think it felt like too similar above ground. But look, that's just what I was thinking. When they went through
That was the last battle, right? The underwater bit.
Yeah, they were the last Jaeger. All the other ones had been destroyed, and they were the analog one, so they could function not only underwater, but
I just thought going it was it portal. Didn't. I just thought it didn't have the same. I was expecting something much more like climactic for the final battle. I think the battle that took place in the city, where he was using the. The big tanker as a club and stuff. I felt like that was so much more, that felt more like a final battle in a way, although it was, and then the final battle itself, it didn't deliver in terms of the kind of the punch, the emotional or the sort of triumphant kind of, you know, moment that you wanted to have. I didn't feel that anyway.
Well, the thing is normally in these movies you'd have one Jaeger fighting one kaiju at the very end for the big battle, right? But in this movie you had five or six of those battles and like six Jaegers or more. So it's the one up kind of thing. Like, how do we, oh, well, the thing that's going to differentiate the final battle is going to be that they go through the portal and you actually see the, what is sending this, you know, now that you figured out that they're clones and they're manufactured and blah, blah, blah. And you get the whole plot point. That I feel like is their big payoff, right?
Well, I guess, and that was the thing, like, you know, we mentioned Oblivion earlier too, and we made that comparison, like I think you did, Jason, and like I think actually that conclusion and that reveal is an apt comparison to Oblivion too, where in Oblivion you kind of finally get to go up into the big, you know, ship or whatever, and it's so anticlimactic. It's like it doesn't really sell, and I don't know that, I mean, at least for me, the story of the kaiju and, you know, that they were these, I mean, I didn't care that they were clones and that, I mean, it seemed like it didn't really matter that much, you know?
Well, it seemed like the clone factory idea was merely just to set up that there is a quote unquote intelligent entity that we will have to face a la Pac Rim 2. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, maybe.
I don't think it was meant to be discussed in this, whatever.
Yeah, okay. So, so notwithstanding my plot problems, we definitely think that the quality of the visual effects was spectacular.
Easily.
And
yeah,
and they were tackling some pretty difficult staging problems.
Yeah, it goes without saying, you put, you know, ILM and, you know, with John Knoll supervising on a project with giant robots and giant monsters, like, I mean, it's going to be visually, it's in terms of the quality of those visual effects, it's going to be spectacular. Like, that's just a given.
Can I tell you a funny story from John Knoll's presentation at SIDGRAPH? There's a scene in
I didn't get to see that. I so wanted to attend that talk.
So there's a scene in Hong Kong where they're fighting, and it's the scene you were referring to earlier with get the boat and use it as a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's a punch that goes awry, goes through the side of a building, goes flying through a whole bunch of office stuff, and ends up just touching a cubicle desk, causing balls to fire and go off.
Yeah.
Okay. So
that was a good gag too. That was a good comedy moment in the movie. It needed more of that kind of camp, and it didn't have enough of that, I thought.
Yeah, I think it needed a bit more of that kind of stuff. But I'm going to relay John Knoll's story, so I apologize in advance if I get some of this wrong, but he was like, well, that's a very different type of shot than the other type of shots. Like, there wasn't a big outdoor, you know, sequence, and Lord only knows there were enough of those. And it wasn't a big monster, you know, kind of Jaeger battle. It was just a really little thing at a completely different sort of scale almost to everything else. So they said, well, we'll do that with a practical. And so they decided that they would build a practical set, which would have all these kind of cubicles, and there would be a camera rig that would run up in parallel to the office space. So you would get a shot of the fist as it went through all the office, camera moving in parallel to the fist. So now imagine you've got basically two battering rams. One is going to plow through the set. One has got a slit that's cut so that it doesn't have to break stuff, but it's got the camera and it's aimed at the fist. Making sense? And okay, so now you build this whole thing, but you're thinking, well, we'd like to have money for two or three takes on this because, you know, what if something goes wrong? No, we don't have money for two or three takes. We'll get it right. Plus, we're working with the guys, you know, the ex-ILM model shop, which is now 3210, and they're very, very clever guys. You know, I've been to 3210. I can vouch for that. Very clever guys. So they get all this and they test it all. So you've got various non-miniature sets, like with tennis balls and water bottles, that has this battering ram kind of fist that comes through. Now, the battering ram fist is actually going to be a green screen element that will be replaced later, but it's going to smash and knock over a bunch of stuff. So they run it several times through to make sure that the camera is framed correctly for where this fist will be and that it's the right speed and it'll come up and it'll follow the fist and then it'll just pan left to the desk as the fist just rides up and bumps it and it starts doing the thing. And the last part of it's going to be live action, but, you know, that's basically how it runs. Mm-hmm. So they've it's all tested. It's all good. Experienced crew. Everyone's there. John Knoll's there. And John played that clip at SIGGRAPH. And you know what happened, didn't you? This thing goes flying through, smashes the set. It's halfway through, smashing the set, and it just stops. And the camera just keeps on coming and pans off the destruction to the non-destructed room and stops. And it's and you just hear someone, I think it's John Knoll, going, oh, dear. Anyway, so they then, we'll just get all the props in the background and move them to the foreground. We'll try and like rebuild it. But they just literally weren't set up for this. So they rebuild as much as they possibly could. Though the ceiling, the tiles, you know, in an office you've got those sort of white ceiling tiles.
Sure, sure.
They didn't have enough of those. So they just, well, okay, we'll patch that from the first take and we won't worry about it. But apart from that, we can pretty much go again and that'll be kind of, you know, maybe okay sort of thing. And they run the whole thing a second time. And, of course, it all does smash correctly the second time. But now you've got a patch in stereo from the camera, right. Which, by the way, was a stereo camera. So it was filmed in stereo. They have to patch basically in stereo two takes together, two destruction sequences, and then comp in top of that or in behind it the actual CG elements for it all smashing up and breaking. I mean, it really was hysterically funny to watch them put all this together. And, of course, the, you know, it worked in the thing, but it would be like, you know, one of those just...
Really? So that's the shot that's in the finished movie then too?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Cool. So there are CG elements added to it, but most of that destruction, most of that shot is a full-on practical stage element shot at the old ILM Kerner building with 3210 and, you know, shot twice because it didn't work.
Well, that actually almost makes me want to go see that movie again just to check that out. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, it was.
I mean, they got lucky that it only... I mean, it could have easily just blasted through and destroyed the desk on the other side, and then they really would have been screwed.
Well, they did. I mean, literally, it was. If you saw the two takes, you'd be like, "Oh, I don't want to be the comp on this," because right, you know, yeah. it was really having to patch bits from this and bits from that to try and get it to kind of work.
I love that kind of stuff, though. I mean, I love that, you know, that the energy and the time and effort that goes into doing something like that. That, you know, it's a physical thing, and like, yeah, it's kind of funny, like it doesn't work, and there's kind of this big oops moment, and they redo it again. But like, I mean, what an amazing feat of both practical and digital, you know, kind of working together to solve this really complex problem that, you know, would have been, you know, total nightmare to work on. But I mean, that's cool. That is that's a neat story.
It does look pretty good. I must admit, I did feel that it was a little different to other shots, but of course it's a different sort of shot as well. So I'm really, even today, not willing to say that it looked different because of the practical nature of it. I think it looked different because we just didn't have many of those tiny little moments of, you know, intimate kind of sort of, you know, you didn't see a finger interacting with stuff. You saw a fist and an arm and a...
Right,
you know,
right.
And
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're right.
Good. I think Charlie Day was a really good addition. Him and I forget the guy's name who played, you know, the two fighting scientists.
Yep.
I thought they were really good comic relief.
Hmm. Yeah, I hated them. But
really? I liked them. I thought it was funny.
That was so, like, I think it would have been great if there was, I think it might have worked better for me if it felt like there was a little bit more of that thread throughout the movie. Like, it was such a tonal shift for me from what I thought was the sort of almost overly dramatic and overly serious part of the battle with the, you know, we're canceling the apocalypse or whatever kind of stuff.
Right.
And then cutting to this kind of almost like, I mean, it was so hammy, almost vaudevillian in its like over the top nature. Well, you know, I mean, to each his own, I guess. And I obviously Del Toro liked it too. I just thought that, and then I thought the Ron Perlman, you know, Del Toro's very own personal Hellboy, you know, in the movie, in that role too. Like, I just thought, I don't know, he didn't bring any really weight or gravitas to that part. Like, it just felt like he was kind of
they were Timon and Pumbaa from The Lion King. You know, the whole of The Lion King was kind of serious-esque, and then suddenly you cut to the two comic characters in classic Disney style. And the meerkat and the warthog just are kind of completely different sort of comic vehicles. And they were the same.
I loved Ron Perlman.
Sorry?
I loved Ron Perlman in that when he says he names one of the kaiju with the Japanese name and he goes, yeah, I think that's my favorite restaurant in Brooklyn. I don't know. We laughed, but we're all from New York, so maybe I don't know. We got it, but I thought the opposite of you, Matt, that I thought that because I hated the plot and the main actor so much, mm-hmm. that seeing something that made me laugh and engage the plot, or not the plot, but engage the film, like, because I liked what they were doing. It was like some yeah. gelato or something, you know, sorbet
yeah, no, that's cool.
in the middle
yeah, that's
of the cool. film, you know.
I could see that. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things, like, for whatever reason, it just didn't click with me when I saw it. But, I mean, yeah. I think, yeah, I could see it. I could see that, too.
Because I didn't connect with the dramatic, like, patriotic nonsense that they were pushing through with the canceling the apocalypse and whatever. And maybe I would have liked that more if I hadn't seen it 80 times in the trailer, but... Mm-hmm. I just did not think that
speech was delivered. That was meant to be, you know, you'll consider your manhood cheap if you're not here this day, St. Crispin Day speech. And unfortunately, you know, Shakespeare just way aced that speech over their speech. I mean, you know, you should be able to improve after a few hundred years of practice. And I was just
Billy
like,
Billy Shakes, man. He was a pretty good writer, that Billy Shakes.
They needed a couple more monkeys in the room at the typewriters.
I'm just saying that, like,
no, I think you're right. I think it can't have that. And that's a great comparison too, the St. Crispin's Day speech. Like, I mean, it really wants to be that, and it can't. And I think one of the reasons why it can't attain that, in terms of the movie in general, is that it can't really reach that kind of height, because I think we're not given enough reason as an audience, like, you know, as a sort of a thinking audience, to really care much about these characters, you know. And I think,
well,
I
mean, you were given Independence Day, they did the same speech, right? They did the 4th of July from here stay forth will be, you know, not just an American holiday. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think it worked that well in Independence Day either, but I thought it worked slightly better than We're Canceling the Apocalypse. I mean, there are occasions when a character gives that kind of, like, you can get sometimes like
Braveheart. Braveheart.
Yeah, I mean, you can get a character to give a speech, but I think Braveheart's a good example. Actually, it was exactly the same speech, and mm-hmm. probably, you know, of the ones we've mentioned, by far the apart from the original Will Shakespeare version, it was probably one of the, you know, the strongest. And if it's done right, and the character just genuinely seems to be incensed and moving to a different place, then, you know, it's very rousing, and it's like, really, like, yeah, it's gonna kick some butt. But in this case, it was like, okay.
Well, there was also never any real peril. I mean, did you ever really think that everything was just going to go to shit and it was going to end like, you know, this uber depressing thing with kaiju destroying the world?
Okay, I will say this
for part two.
I watched the other night, jet lagged in Anaheim, the original Matrix film. And at the end of that, they had the he's still in the Matrix, the things breaking through the craft. They've got the button pressed, ready to be pressed for the EM pulse to save it. There are lasers zapping. She's like, come on, you know, don't die. His heartbeat stops. The thing's crashing through. You're like, press the goddamn button, but you can't because it'll kill him. And like, that was what I want. I want that kind of multiple sort of peril at multiple levels. Like, I got to tell you, watching The Matrix again, I was stunned at how good it was. I'd kind of been a bit, you know, flippant about The Matrix, but the original one was really good. But that end climax works really well when you have multiple levels of peril. Like, if he's giving that speech because they're trying to do something because they themselves are, you know, in mortal danger and they're going to fight even though they know they're going to die just to buy enough hours so as to allow him to complete his mission, when we kind of – and we care about those characters and there's some personal sacrifice – and did anyone we really care about die in this film? I think everybody pretty much survived, didn't they?
Yeah.
A couple
of
Russians
I wished had been killed, but they lived.
The guy that looked like he was, the Russian version of Vanilla Rice, that guy.
Yeah, Boris Badenov.
I think he bought the farm, didn't he?
I have to say, you mentioned the Russian. I loved of all of the robots, I loved the design of the Russian robot with that weird, freaky head. That was so cool.
The Chernobyl reference, yeah.
Yeah, that
and
was awesome.
Can I,
that was just
can
so
I
great.
Also point out the three-armed, were they what were they, Japanese or Korean?
Chinese.
The triplets.
Yeah.
The arm was placed very oddly, and they got killed very fast.
Yeah.
And let's not, you know, yeah, I mean, the vastly horrendous sort of cultural stereotypes of, you know.
Yes.
But
if only they were playing ping pong, you know, against each other.
We thought the Australian one would look better in a pair of Speedos with a surfboard under the other arm. But anyway.
Yeah, that would be good, right?
And a shrimp.
You know, we don't even eat shrimp in this country. We eat prawns. Anyway, yeah. But look, I don't know. It is being cut a lot of slack. I mean, somebody made this point to me the other day. If you were to compare the kind of criticism that was aimed at Man of Steel for not, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and then the free passes given to Pac Rim, clearly people kind of got behind Pac Rim and just sort of generally wanted killer robots and killer monsters and just went, you know what, I'm with you. Let's just do it.
Well, and I think there's actually, there's a lot of people who really just, they love Guillermo del Toro. I think that's another thing too. I think he has a huge fan base. I mean, I think people really are, he's like a, you know, I think Guillermo del Toro is fine. Like, but I mean, you know, people love Peter Jackson, I think, in the same way. Like they kind of, you know, I don't share that necessarily, but I just think that's part of it. I feel like there's this warmth that people feel for del Toro.
Well, I think people think of del Toro outside the system still, right? He kind of does what he wants and has this ability to call his own shots, or at least, again, that's the way it appears. He's at the mercy of the pocketbook like anybody else. But I would, based on the Man of Steel comment, I would say if you read both scripts, Man of Steel would be easily a better script.
Oh, yeah.
Execution-wise, I cared about Clark Kent more than I cared about Charlie Hunnam's lead character. Or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but come Oscar time, are you going to care more about Man of Steel's effects or Pac Rim's effects?
No. Well, they're on par at certain places, but overall, Pacific Rim's the larger leap to create that world, I would give it to Pacific Rim.
Matt?
Yeah, I would say the same. I mean, my only wish that I didn't get in Pac Rim, I've already cited, which was I would love to have seen some wider shots. And I really would love to have seen more stuff in broad daylight, which I know would have been harder to do, but it was all at night and in the rain. And I just was like, I wanted to soak that in. And I felt like I didn't get the chance to in the way that I really was expecting.
I don't know how much visual effects is in it, but apparently there's an hour cut out of the film.
Wow.
And there's going to be, which I would argue is probably the wrong hour he cut out. and apparently Iñárritu and Cuarón both did editing passes on the film, which also doesn't fill me full of hope for some of the stuff because they're also great filmmakers. But I think Iñárritu, they said, took out 30 minutes. And Cuarón like shuffled some stuff around,
and that's the great scene in which the you know, the Jaegers do the kind of rap dancing kind of thing, and they do the kind of the night before the event kind of dance off, you know.
Yeah, and they all get into a Kia Soul and drive away in a like hamsters.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, it is without a doubt a monumental achievement to realize some of the shots in this film. I mean, it's staggeringly complicated, especially the Sims work, the rigid body Sims to the... But I also think more than any film we've seen lately, there's been some horrendous challenges for the animation team that they managed to solve at a level I didn't think they would. I would actually expected going in to be really frustrated by the jumping between the guys controlling it and the actual exterior shots of the Jaegers, and because they can't move at the same speed and clearly... You know, it would take you a very long time to take the steps that the Jaeger takes, so inside would be weird. Though one person at ILM did suggest they actually thought about that and there was some kind of time delay, lag thing, compensation thing. But doesn't matter. The animation team, obviously helped by the editors, solved some really difficult problems and in a really, really convincing way, made a phenomenally interesting set of, you know, as action pieces, as fight sequences, I think we'd all agree that they were great. They were, you know, really, really good. Yeah,
phenomenal.
Yeah.
It is. Hats off to all the visual effects team, I think, on the film. I mean, it really is, I think, work that, you know, you could just be so proud of. I mean, it's really just so impressive on so many levels. I mean,
oh, yeah, there was no shots you wouldn't want on your reel, for sure.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah. But it would be even nicer if they came back with a stronger plot to reward the efforts of the visual effects artists that are going to put so much work into it. It would be nice if they had a stronger, because, you know, I understand the popcorn thing. I do think that it is valid to say that you're meant to suspend disbelief, and picking it apart like I tend to do is stupid. And yes, I know I'm the guy that came up with all the physics questions on how much Spider-Man would swing, but you know, look, it is tying into whether it's believable and whether or not you're engaging. And we are only there, after all, to tell the story. So I guess we want the story to be a good story to tell. But, yeah, look, they knocked it out of the park. And then some in terms of the looks, especially the rendering and stuff, it was spectacular. But I don't think this is going to go down in history as one of my all-time favorite films that I can't wait till it comes out on iTunes so I can watch it again and again and again. I was not in love with this like I did a Skyfall and like I hope to be with, say, Elysium or perhaps some of the other films coming up later in the year like Gravity. But, hey, that's just me. Guys, thanks so much for being with us on the show. We really do appreciate it. Matt, where can people track you down, follow you, find out what you're doing?
You can always find me on the Twitters at Matt Wallen or on my website, which is mattwallen.com. And just a quick side plug, too. I had the opportunity, a friend of the show, Paul Zaddy, asked me to participate in his new podcast, the Visual Story Podcast, where he asks different guests to come on, and he graciously asked me to come on, and I was happy to do it. And he said, you know, pick any movie you want and some aspect of filmmaking that you want to talk about. And so we did a show that I actually think turned out really great. It's actually a pretty cool conversation about one of my favorite movies from the 70s, Alan Pakula's All the President's Men, about Watergate. Mm. And so there's a link to that on my website, or you can find that one too in iTunes. It's Visual Story Podcast, and it's Paul Zadie's. And he's got now a couple other episodes too. And it's just kind of fun. It's not visual effects related necessarily, but it's more about like filmmaking, like the craft of filmmaking and telling a story visually. So anyway.
And Jason?
Plug there.
Yeah, my brother and I are still trying to pick our movie for our episode of that too. I'm vacillating between a few. And I have to, I haven't looked at the list lately. I definitely want to get yours. You can find me at thediamondbros.com and on the Twitters at Jason Diamond.
Brilliant. And just to cross-promote, we just put out a new episode of the RC where we talking not only to Ted Schulowitz at Red about some of the developments, which was recorded last week, but just yesterday we spoke to Mark Toy, who has a new Epic Dragon. This is a tie-in because Pac Rim was actually shot with the Epic MX camera, and this is the next generation that goes from 5K to 6K. And
listen to that one.
Yeah, so that podcast is
I've been talking to him about it.
Yep, that podcast is also up on FX Guide. And, of course, I'm Mike Seymour over on the Twitters. Guys, thanks so much for being with us. Thank you for listening. We've got some great shows coming up. As I said before, we've got Gravity and Elysium. We've got some really good stuff planned and coming. And a couple of surprises you may not be expecting, really, from left field. But more of that when we get closer. Until next time, we're going to cancel the criticism. I'm Mike Seymour. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com.